I want you to open your Bible to 2 Samuel chapter 9. We are going to start at the very beginning of the chapter again, because I had to go into some detail of the background of this story that we're just going to very quickly summarize here at the beginning. I am of the opinion that this story takes place in the 14th year of King David, during the second sabbatical year of David's kingdom. It's the year 1004, starting in the fall of 1004, going until the fall of 1003. During that period, David would have been, like most Israelis, taking the year off from the normal work and reflecting upon life and blessings and God and God's intentions. And I think he remembers his late friend Jonathan, who had been killed at the Battle of Mount Gilboa 14 years earlier, and a promise that he made to him that he would take care of Jonathan's family. And I think it maybe dawns on him he hasn't followed through with that yet. And so here is the story from its beginning. David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So that's spoken to his servants, and his servants apparently do some research, and this happens next, verse 2. "Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. They called him to David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' And he said, 'I am your servant.' And the king said, 'Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?'" Now, I believe he is very focused on the Jonathan line. And so that is where Ziba goes for an answer. "Ziba said to the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in his feet.'" And we know that story. It happened 14 years ago during the evacuation of the capital city because they were afraid that the Philistines had come there next. The young man was only 5 years old at the time. His nurse fell on top of him after, you know, trying to carry him, but fell on top of him, broke his feet. They didn't get set immediately, so he has been crippled ever since. So the king said, "Where is he?" So where is this young man? Ziba said to the king, "He's in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo-Debar." That seems to be somewhere on the east side of the upper Jordan Valley, in the area where King Saul's people retreated to and set up their kingdom after the death of King Saul. And so that makes sense that that's where this young man would have grown up and where he's apparently living under the guardianship of someone. Verse 6 finally mentions his name, but it is a name that's been changed by later scribes. So I'm going to always use the circumcised name that he would have had that has been retained in the First Chronicles passages about him. So, Merib Baal, which literally means "the Lord is my advocate," because during this time in Israeli history, Baal, a Canaanite noun, was used as a synonym for the Hebrew noun Adonai, which means Lord, and both of those, Baal and Adonai, were used as synonyms for the divine name, Yahweh. So when his name is Merib Baal, it means the Lord, he who is my advocate. He's the one that sticks up for me. So that's the name that he was given when he was first born. Merib Baal, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David. And he fell on his face, and he paid homage. So David summons him, has him picked up and brought to him. It's a good day's travel, possibly part of 2 days' travel for him to get there. And no doubt he is very scared. He's only about 19, maybe 20 years of age. He's been staying out of the public eye of David and anyone else. He is worried, I think, instantly by the fact that the custom in the Middle East at this time was the new dynasty always wiped out everybody of the old dynasty to make sure that there were no challenges for the kingdom. And so that's probably what he is worried about. So he falls on his face. He pays homage to King David. David says his name out loud. Meribbaal. And I'm going to do some little speculation here. We know that people look like their parents. And even though David didn't know Jonathan when he was 21, Jonathan was probably in his later 20s when David first met him. I think he might be able to see some of Jonathan in him. And it really touches him. Oh, Meribbaal. And he answered, "Behold, I'm your servant." And David said to him, "Do not be afraid. Do not fear. I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan." The word for kindness here, guys, is chesed. It's that loving kindness thing that we always talk about. He cares about him. He wants what's best for this young man because he's Jonathan's kid. And he promised Jonathan that he would take care of his family. And so he goes on and gets very specific. "I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always." So you're going to come and live at Jerusalem. You're going to live at the palace. You're going to be taken care of by my staff. You will always be eating at my table from here on out. And by the way, I am going to take all of the property of your grandfather and your father, and it's going to be given to you. All the proceeds from it will belong to you. What this basically means is that Ziba now has a new boss, and that's not going to make him happy. We'll talk about that. Verse 8, he paid homage. That is, he probably was still down on the floor. And he says, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" You might recognize that language because David used it on a couple of occasions when he was speaking to people more senior to him, like King Saul, for example. That this young man is shocked that somebody of David's stature, the king of United Israel, would show him such kindness. Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat." So he basically tells Ziba, who has been administering the property of Saul, apparently for his own benefit. That needs to be understood here. There doesn't seem to have been any Saul descendants that were calling the shots for Ziba. Ziba was just being the caretaker of all this property and doing things the way he wanted to and benefiting from the proceeds. And now suddenly he's not in charge anymore. He's got a 19 or 20-year-old master. Now he's going to be an absentee master because he's not going to live in Benjamin territory. He's going to live just south of the Benjamite border at Jerusalem. Well, actually, Jerusalem is technically in the very southern edge of Benjamite territory, but it's kind of an independent entity now that David has made it the capital city. So it says here that all that belonged to Saul and to his house, I've given to your master's sons. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Merib-Baal, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. So he'll be at Jerusalem all the time. You guys will be working his properties for him. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So he's pretty well to do. Ziba said to the king, according to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do. So he sounds very deferential. He sounds that he will agree to do whatever it is that David wants him to do. But I'm telling you right now, my suspicion, my belief based on a later story, is that Ziba is very upset by the change in his status here. From being the guy that controlled everything to suddenly being the guy that has to follow the orders of someone much younger than him. Now, verse 12 helps us understand Merib-Baal's age a little bit better. So Merib-Baal ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. So David, for all intents and purposes, has adopted him. So that's he's going to grow up as one of David's kids. Now, he's already grown up. He's already reached pretty much the majority age of Jewish men, which is 20. But David will probably also adopt as his adopted grandson, Merib-Baal's own son, who's mentioned in verse 12. Merib-Baal had a young son whose name was Micah, which is apparently a shortened version of Mikael or Micaiah, which means who's like God or who's like Yahweh. All who lived in Ziba's house became Merib-Baal's servants. And so Merib-Baal lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now, he was lame in both his feet. So that needs to be a reminder all the time, especially for the ultimate story that we'll come to. It's coming soon. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 21. Now, this story has to happen after the story we just told, because Merib-Baal is mentioned in it as someone known to David. So it can't precede the other story. But it also seems to be early on in David's reign, because of some circumstances that I'll explain as we go along. Verse 1 of 2 Samuel 21 says, now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the face of He Who Is. Now, a famine usually follows a drought. Rain is not coming down in the winter months to get the crop, the grain crops were always put in the late fall and they were watered by the cold, wet winter rains, and then they started growing in the later winter, and then the late winter rains, the early spring rain, really helped them come to their full produce by the time late spring happened. And so that's, rain is very important. So if it doesn't happen, if the early rain, the late rain does not show up, then you end up with a famine. The crops don't produce. A three-year famine, 3 years without rain, is really bad. And for the Jewish perspective, 1 year without rain, that might be a fluke. 2 years or more, God is probably indicating that there's a problem in the land. Now, there is a particular combo that is bad for a three-year famine, and that would be this one. You've got the 6 years of work that the Jewish people typically do, followed by a sabbatical year where they don't do the agricultural work. So here's the deal. The sixth year's harvest needs to be very productive so that when you put it away, there would be more than enough to get you through the Sabbath year and through the first part of the first year of the next cycle. So if you have no rain in the sixth year of the agricultural cycle, you're not going to get a good crop. You can't work in the seventh year of the cycle. So that puts 2 years in a row that you're in trouble food-wise. And then if you don't get any rain in the first year of the next cycle, then that's 3 years in a row that you're really struggling because of lack of food. And so my suspicion is that chapter 21, verse 1, describes a situation bracketing that sabbatical year that we were just talking about in the earlier story. That basically, the year before David meets Meribbaal, there was no rain. The year David meets Meribbaal was a sabbatical year. There was no rain. And I believe that in the following year, there was no rain. And so by then, David knows God must be doing this. And the belief based on the book of Deuteronomy, you know, the blessing and the cursing is, we must be sinners. We must have sin in the camp. We need to find out what it's about. So chapter 21, verse 1 continues by saying, David sought the face of He Who Is, which means he probably went to the priest, asked them to use the Urim and the Thummim, and asked some pointed questions about this three-year drought, three-year famine. So He Who Is said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. So this is another reason I think it has to happen fairly early on. Because Saul has been dead for 14, going on 15 years, I think, by the time this story is taking place. And so it's something he did 14 or 15 years ago that has not yet been dealt with. So David gets this information that it's got to do with a massacre that King Saul and his people carried out against the Gibeonites. Now you may remember that Gibeon is the site of the tabernacle. And we know that there was a massacre of the priests that took place near the tabernacle at Nob in the 2 years before Saul died, 2 years before David became king. But that was all Jewish people. That was all Israeli people. This is the Gibeonite people who are actually Canaanites. It goes back to the time of Joshua, 400 plus years ago. The Gibeonites figured out that the Israelis were going to be executing all Canaanites living inside the Promised Land. So they got a plan hatched where they would pretend to be from outside the Promised Land and have the Israelis enter into a treaty with them, and then they would survive beyond the Israelis coming into the land. And it worked because the Israelis didn't check in with God. They made the treaty with the Gibeonites and then found out later that they were actually Canaanites living just over the ridgeline from where the Israelis were carrying on operations. So Joshua said, all right, you Gibeonites have to serve the tabernacle from here on out. You have to carry water for the tabernacle. You have to also cut wood and carry wood and all of that for the tabernacle. So that's the way that all the descendants of the Gibeonites have been carrying on their lives ever since. Could be why the tabernacle ends up being brought to Gibeon in the first place. Well, Saul apparently got it in his head toward the end of his reign that God was mad at him for not clearing out Gentiles, not clearing out the Canaanites. So he goes in and apparently killed off a whole bunch of Gibeonites without direction from God. And he violated that treaty from way back in the time of Joshua. That's what the problem is. Verse 2, so the king called the Gibeonites. So David makes an arrangement to talk to the Gibeonites. He spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but of a remnant of the Amorites. Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah, just like I explained. So David says to the Gibeonites who have been murdered, the people who hadn't loved ones murdered, what shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of he who is? In other words, how can I satisfy what happened to you in such a way that we can get past God's curse and the drought? The Gibeonites said to him, it's not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house, so we're not looking for money. Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. So we don't have the right to execute people personally, but that's what we want. We want people executed for what happened. So they said to the king, the man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel, let seven of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before he who is at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of he who is. So we want seven of Saul's descendants that are still alive executed. And we want them executed at Gibeah, which tells me probably seven Gibeonites had been killed. And so they want eye for an eye, which was part of the biblical law. The king said, I will give them. But the king spared Merib-Baal, the son of Saul's son, Jonathan, because of the oath of he who is that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So this is why we know it has to happen after the story from 2 Samuel 9. So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni, and another Merib-Baal, and the five sons of Merib, the daughter of Saul. That's the lady that David was originally supposed to marry, but refused to marry her. That's Michal's big sister, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite, and he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites. So he gives seven living sons of King Saul into the hands of the Gibeonites. Now, before you get too far into thinking, wow, these guys are innocent and they're being handed over for execution, who said they're innocent? I think there is every possibility that these guys were participants in the slaughter that was taking place under King Saul's leadership of the Gibeonites. And so I think that they are probably going to be killed for their own crimes. That's my opinion. So he gave them into their hands. They hanged them on the mountain before he who is, and the seven of them perished together. Basically, they would have stoned them. Then they would have displayed their bodies on a tree there at Gibeah of Saul. Now, typically, they were supposed to bury the bodies before the close of day. But something happens. They were put to death in the first days of harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest. Barley harvest happens in the first month of the Jewish year. So think later March, maybe early April. But Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. So basically, one of the moms, possibly both of them, won't let the bodies be buried. She keeps them out there and won't allow them to be entombed. And she does it for months. But we're out of time, so we'll have to save that for the next time we're into the Word.